Spirit Blade Underground Episode 352. Warning, access restricted. Please submit to DNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Audio file encryption processing. Transmission decoded. Begin playback for system file. Spirit Blade Underground Episode 352.
Hello, hello. Welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast, a biblical examination and celebration of geekery and geek entertainment, as well as the official podcast of ChristianGeekCentral.com, a website and community you can check out at ChristianGeekCentral.com. All right, misread my script there. All right, I'm Paeter Fernandez from Spirit Blade Productions, producing entertainment and resources to equip, encourage, and inspire Christian geeks like you and me to live more and more for Christ. Honestly, I'm kind of selfish because I feel like a lot of this time I'm just doing this for me. It's weird podcasting. I've been podcasting for I don't know how long now, quite a while. And there really still is that sense that you're just kind of talking into the void sometimes. But processing all this stuff that I do is always good for me. So that would be enough, I think. Although I might not go through the trouble of like doing all the mixing and editing and crap if I was really the only one listening. Anyway, for more info about whatever it was I just last said in the script and free goodies, check out spiritblade.com. Okay, on the show today, David Arrington brings us part one of his thoughts on Doctor Who Season 2, and I share my love of one of my favorite Japanese RPGs of all time, Shadow Hearts for the PlayStation 2, as well as Shadow Hearts Covenant for the PlayStation 2. All right, here we go!
Hello, Spirit Bladers. This is David Arrington, back once again with another Doctor Who segment, this time focusing on Season 2 of Doctor Who. Season 2 of the reboot of Doctor Who, I should say. And in case you haven't heard the first segment of my Doctor Who series here, you can check out episodes 335 and 337 of the Spirit Blade podcast for those segments. Season 2 of Doctor Who features the David Tennant version of Doctor Who as opposed to last season's Christopher Eccleston's version of Doctor Who, because in case you didn't know, Doctor Who can basically reincarnate when he's about to die and turn into a new person with a slightly different personality. So what did I think of David Tennant's Doctor? Basically, yeah, I like this Doctor too. I mean, the Doctor is always a fun character. I don't know if I've ever seen a Doctor. I'm like, I don't like this Doctor Who. But I think he's a fun character. I think that he is a little bit darker. He has a little bit more of a darker edge. I mean, he's still light and happy and kind of go-lucky Doctor that he always is. But underneath, he seems to be hiding maybe a darker personality. He's a little bit more judgmental, like quicker to judgment than, and less gracious than the previous Doctor was, and not so much so that he's like out murdering people or anything necessarily, but he just seems to be slightly darker, have a darker tone or a darker edge than the Christopher Eccleston Doctor did. And season to season, comparing David Tennant's Doctor to Christopher Eccleston's Doctor, you know, who did I like better as a Doctor? Well, one season as compared to one season, I'm gonna say I like Christopher Eccleston's Doctor better. I think Christopher Eccleston is even more maybe charismatic than David Tennant. David Tennant he's a cool, I like him as an actor, and I think he does some really good stuff here, but I also think I just like kind of the personality of the Christopher Eccleston Doctor better than David Tennant's Doctor. Though I think they both do some really good stuff, and I do like them both. Now, as a series, this series as a whole, this season as a whole in American terms, series in British terms. So I'll say this season as a whole was very enjoyable. I thought that, you know, once again, as with the first season, it's not really strung together at all. It's basically just a bunch of random adventures with these characters, and you can pretty much watch them in any order and it wouldn't change a whole lot. I mean, there's some, like, the first episode's made to go first, the last episode's made to go last. And you could pretty much switch around the episodes in the middle and it wouldn't change too much. Though, like, there is a couple things, like, Mickey joins them for a while. And, you know, so there's a couple episodes where he's in there along with the Doctor, which is fun. I definitely enjoyed that. I think they did some really good stuff with Mickey this season around that made me like him as a character a lot more so than I had as of yet watching this series. And so, definitely thumbs up for, you know, cool, I like Mickey better now. So, overall, as a series, and, you know, as a season, I really enjoyed it, and I thought it was very solid and fun. I thought maybe there could have been somewhat stronger connective tissue, though I did think that this series, the line that was running through it, which was basically Torchwood, that was, like, the theme that was kind of running through this series. It was really light. It didn't really string the episodes together much other than saying the word Torchwood and Torchwood showing up now and again and, you know, kind of doing their thing. I don't even know that you could call that a story arc. And I don't know, I guess I like story arcs over seasons. And so if there was a little bit more of something like that, I would appreciate it. But overall, this is still really fun. Alright, now I'm going to start running down episode by episode, kind of, you know, maybe I won't say all the episodes, but I just want to go through saying, you know, so these are some of the things I liked, these are some of the things that I didn't love about this series and these specific episodes. Well, let's talk about the mini episode that you can find online for free called Doctor Who Children in Need, which is basically a mini episode that takes place immediately after the Doctor regenerates in the first episode. And basically it's Rose deciding whether, you know, wait a minute, is this the same person? Can I actually trust this person? Is this person actually the Doctor, or is this some alien playing tricks on me? I thought it was pretty cool to see, like, her instant reaction right when it happened, because I didn't see that until after I watched this whole series, actually, but I thought that was kind of cool to see what happened immediately after Series 1 ended. Alright, so the first episode is a Christmas special. Cool, I'm all for these, but really, this was not a strong start out to this series. Basically, this is the first episode with David Tennant as the Doctor. So, cool, a new Doctor. You know, what is he gonna be like? What's his personality? Well, throughout pretty much the whole episode, he was incapacitated. So, this big new Doctor that you're, you know, has been being played by this new actor and everything, it's like, alright, let's introduce him. And you have him incapacitated through almost the entire episode. Where is the logic in that? That makes no sense to me. I didn't even mind what they were going for necessarily. But, dude, if you're gonna try to introduce someone, have them in the episode. It was annoying to not see him when I thought I should be seeing him, because this is the introductory episode to him as a character. So that was kind of weird. Next up, we have New Earth, which is technically the episode number one, because the previous episode was a Christmas special. This is an episode number one of this series, and it's called New Earth. Basically, it brings back one of my least favorite villains from season one, which is the moisturize me lady. So annoying. I don't like that lady. But then they do a whole mind swap thing, which is interesting. It's a pretty good episode, but it could have been better. Next up, we have Tooth and Claw, where the Doctor and Rose meet Queen Victoria, and they're tying into history and yet keeping it in line with what history is. There was cool monk assassins, some surprisingly good action, werewolves, terrible CGI. this is Doctor Who at its best. Check out Tooth and Claw if you're, you know, just going through trying to pick out the best of Doctor Who. This is some good stuff. School Reunion is next, where we meet Sarah Jane Smith, who was a companion to the Doctor in the older series, and now she's back. And, you know, she's just back for the episode. And this really highlights the weird relationship between Rose, Sarah Jane, Mickey, and the Doctor. Like, their whole relationship with each other, whether they are boyfriend, girlfriend, who loves who, and, like, what is going on with these relationships. This kind of highlights just kind of how weird this whole the Doctor and his companion thing is. Overall, pretty good episode, though. Sarah Jane Smith goes on to star in her own TV series for a few seasons or so, and I'll probably talk about that in the future. I haven't seen any of it, but I don't know. Her character here was pretty good. I don't know how well she'll hold up on her own, but I guess we'll see. Next up is The Girl in the Fireplace. This, they're really trying to do something creative. You know, they're trying to look at, like, this whole girl's life and looking at it all at once and where the Doctor interjects into her life and what is happening there and what he's doing. It's all, they're going for something very creative and interesting, and it mostly worked for me. There was some stuff that didn't quite work for me, but it was mostly worked. I really enjoyed that episode. Next up, we have Rise of the Cybermen and Age of Steel, which is really, you know, focusing on the Cybermen, which is a classic Doctor Who villain, I suppose. And we're introduced to parallel worlds here, and we're introduced to Cybermen. And the Cybermen, they're all right villains, though I found their final defeat kind of dumb. I don't know. It's mixed reactions to the final defeat. I didn't mind how he defeated them, per se, but what happened once he defeated them, kind of lame. They also did some really good stuff with Mickey in this episode, having Mickey and a parallel Mickey. That was some good stuff there. Next up, we have The Idiot's Lantern. This is a prime example of a bad villain dragging down a good villain concept, because I thought the concept of the villain inside the TV and everything was pretty cool, but the lady that plays the villain on the TV is super annoying and saying, "Feed me, feed me!" Repeating the same line over and over does not make you intimidating. It just makes you really annoying here in this instance. Then, next up, we have The Impossible Planet and the Satan Pit, which, the Doctor fights the devil in these episodes. And, you know what? I think I might talk about... I'm not going to talk about this very much here, other than to say these are actually some of the better episodes here. I may actually talk about those two episodes in their own segment, so look out for that later on. Then the second-to-last episode is called Love and Monsters. I really like the idea of these episodes they do, where they have the Doctor barely in it, and then they basically have... this is how other people see the Doctor, and so you have this character and his, like, support group, and then the Doctor comes in and some stuff happens. It's kind of interesting, but the final villain I thought was pretty dumb and gross and just not that great, and so there was some good stuff. I enjoyed it. I thought it could have been better, though. Though I do, and I think they should continue doing these episodes where the Doctor is hardly in one of them, and you see the Doctor from a point of view outside of the Doctor and his companion. It's kind of interesting stuff there to see what that's like. Then the final story is a two-parter, Army of Ghosts and Doomsday, and this is a great finale. This is a great ending to this series and to finish off Rose's major portion of her story in this series, because this is basically her ending for this series, and we're going to move on to a different companion in the next series, I guess. And they really did a terrific job with wrapping everything up from this season and with her character and all of that really some great and surprisingly emotional at points, some good stuff there. But then there's this weird cliffhanger thing at the end of the series that's like 5 seconds where it's like, hey, look at this thing. What? This doesn't make any sense. What? Okay. The end. And like, if I remember right, I'm pretty sure I've seen the first episode of season 3. And if I remember right, this doesn't have much to do with anything other than that first episode. And so it doesn't really make sense to put that at the end of season 2. But maybe I'm mistaken. Maybe there's something else to go on there. Alright, that's all for part 1 of my segment. Yep, I'm gonna have to divide this segment up in 2 parts also, because I have some more stuff to talk about with Rose and with the Doctor. And so I'm just gonna have to close it off right here. But I just wanted to remind you guys that I am not a major Doctor Who fan. I am not a Whovian. And I am putting this out there to all you Whovians. If you want to do a Doctor Who segment for the Spirit Blade podcast, please contact me, contact Pater, and tell us. We want you to take this over. And so that way, a real Whovian, a real Doctor Who fan can be the leader of the Doctor Who charge of awesomeness that I'm doing right now, even though I'm not a major Doctor Who fan. I'm just a light general fan of Doctor Who. And I want you to take this over so that you can do your favorite TV show and your favorite character justice. You can email me at helixreviewspodcast@gmail.com. You can check out the Helix Reviews Podcast on iTunes. That's all for now. See you next time, guys.
I want to remind you guys to check out the other podcasts in the Christian Geek Central Network, such as the Strangers and Aliens podcast, the Theology Gaming podcast, and the Untold podcast. For more information about the CGC Network, visit ChristianGeekCentral.com.
Time machine activated. Retro review launched. Sequence initiated. Historical destination locked. Temporal displacement in 3, 2, 1.
All right, the year is 2001. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone and Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, both playing in theaters. Gamers are testing their skills with Grand Theft Auto 3, Max Payne, and Final Fantasy X. And Geoff Johns brought Hawkman back from the dead, or from out of continuity limbo, in the pages of Justice Society of America. And I also got a letter printed in JSA number 26 that year. 2001 also saw the U.S. release of Shadow Hearts for the PlayStation 2, followed in 2004 by Shadow Hearts Covenant, and in 2006 by Shadow Hearts From the New World. So my thoughts today are going to be focused on the first 2 games in the series. After reading some promising tidbits in PlayStation Magazine, I found myself a used copy of the original Shadow Hearts for PlayStation 2, hoping that it would just kind of tide me over until Square released a new Final Fantasy game. And what happened was that I discovered not just a half-decent tied-me-over JRPG, but a game that, for my tastes, blew Final Fantasy X out of the water. Let's talk about the story and script of both games. They're set in an alternate history pre-World War I Europe. Although there's some modern tech that exists. So, I mean, if you get caught up in, like, the trappings of, you know, that, it's not at all true to the history. I mean, the clothes aren't really the same. It's just kind of like a mashup of styles and ideas and stuff with that rough time period as kind of like its default to start with. But, I mean, there's, like, radio technology, spy technology, because one of the characters in your party in the first game is like a female spy from America, and she's got all kinds of spy tech that, like, I mean, didn't remotely exist. It was more like, you know, almost 2001 kind of technology, you know. It's very Cthulhu-inspired and dark, you know, that very kind of ominous, the supernatural is this dark other world, and too much exposure to it will drive you insane. We can't handle the realities that exist in the spiritual world, you know. It's that kind of a setting. Your party is a group of supernatural investigators, I guess kind of like Ghostbusters, that go around and solve supernatural mysteries. Although you're not really solving mysteries in the game, you're just going to people like, oh, my dead husband is haunting us, you know, can you do something about it? And then you do something about it, you know. So I guess they're like investigators and exorcists in that sense. So during the games, you're going around banishing evil creatures, and in the first game, you're also trying to stop an evil wizard who wears this awesome top hat from using a young girl that's in your party who has some unique attributes, mysterious attributes about her that can be used potentially to destroy the world, of course. And so he's trying to get her, and you're kind of on the run, and then you're trying to kind of chase him down and fight him at the same time, too. You know, it's, you know, that kind of stuff. The first game is mostly text-driven. It's a blend of strange, creepy, you know, kind of story, and with small amounts of offbeat humor. But for the most part, it's a fairly dark and serious story. The story, I think, though, is only interesting because it's different, because the setting's different, because it doesn't use quite all of the same kinds of cliches that you would find in other traditional Japanese RPGs. So the story is not, I didn't think, super compelling in and of itself. But it's interesting just because it's different, and even today I think it's different, and you might be asking yourself, wow, where are they going to go with this, and what kind of ideas and concepts are they going to be exploring here? So I think it's still interesting, even though it's not, like, really compelling, and you're like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen next? You know, it's not one that I really was emotionally involved in. The Covenant story, Shadowheart's Covenant, the second game in the series, that story is similar, except the one with the unique characteristics inside of them that could potentially be used to destroy the world is the hero from the first game. And he's really the only returning main character in the second game in the series. All the characters from the first game do not return for the second game. But now he's kind of being chased down and used and abused for his potential power to destroy the world. Although Shadowheart's Covenant goes much heavier on the side of comedy, and the kind of silly, goofy Japanese anime comedy that's actually a big turnoff for me. So that's a bit of a bummer. Now, the first game is technically a sequel to a PS1 game called Kudelka, but you really don't have to know anything about that game to get into Shadowhearts. In fact, I didn't even know, I don't think, that Shadowhearts was a pseudo-sequel to Kudelka until after I'd been playing the game or after I'd finished the game. I eventually did go back and buy Kudelka to give it a try, and the gameplay is entirely different. It's still a very dark setting and, you know, and very similar in that way to Shadowhearts 1, but the gameplay, the combat, I just hated it. I hated it. And so I ultimately got rid of it. I didn't get more than a few hours into it, actually. Okay, the graphics and sound. So, I mean, these are PlayStation 2 games, which you might expect. The first one has a lot of pre-rendered backgrounds that your 3D sprites are moving around on. The second game, much more often, has full 3D backgrounds. I don't know that that's necessarily a plus. I really liked the dark, detailed backgrounds of the first game, and you lose some of that in that era of video games when you transition from that into full 3D backgrounds. You know, even though the camera can move in ways that, you know, it of course couldn't when it's pre-rendered backgrounds, you lose some detail, I think, in some of those backgrounds. And so that's, you know, it's a minor thing. It's apples and oranges, really. It's two different types of approaches to a game like this. Let's see here. The creature design is bizarre and disturbing in the first game. I mean, you've got, like, you're fighting dogs that, instead of, like, snouts, have human arms, and they're, like, balancing on those arms so that their legs are sticking up in the air, and then they turn around and things will come out of them, and it's like, really disturbing. You know, so, I mean, if you like monster-type creature designs from, like, movies like John Carpenter's The Thing, then you'll probably really just be fascinated by these weird designs. They can just be very disturbing sometimes. And you've also got, like, giant baby fetus monsters, you know, weird, dark, disturbing stuff. It was much more toned down in Shadowheart's Covenant. I would say that there are even creatures in Shadowheart's Covenant that are just silly. Like, near the beginning of the game, you're fighting little wooden toy soldiers and toy trains and stuff. It's weird. It's weird. But not creepy weird. Spell animations in both games are just dazzling and repeatedly interesting and enjoyable to watch. The voice acting in both games, it's very typical JRPG corny from that era, and even from modern anime. So, I mean, if you're used to Japanese, you know, anime where they're going, oh, and making weird, totally unnecessary noises and using inflection that's just over the top and not subtle at all and just weird, you're not going to have any problems with either of these games. Now, the first game is mostly text-based, so if you're like me and that stuff bothers you, it's not going to be a big deal except for just in a few cutscenes spread out throughout the first game. In the second game, much more often, they use cutscenes that are in-engine, so there are frequent in-engine cutscenes that use full voice acting. And that, combined with the script being lighter and more jokey, I put that in quotes because I don't think any of those things are funny, but, you know, it'll make that second game more annoying to you if you don't like that kind of thing. And there's no option to turn the voices off, so that really sucks. Music in both games is very unique, and it's a perfect fit for the bizarre, otherworldly setting. If I were to try to describe it, it's like a blend of industrial music and Eastern tribal traditions, and with some gothic, ancient Christian church sounds thrown in, like organ. But the final effect is awesome. I love the score for both of these games. It's just, I mean, it's not really music that you'd really hum to, you know, I mean, it's like, it's got these weird kind of, you know, chanting things in the background. So, I mean, you're not going to, you know, unless you're into that kind of music, you're not going to be driving around and humming that chant, you know, but it fits the tone of these games so well. The first game also has tons of creepy atmospheric orchestral effects common to supernatural horror films. Very atmospheric in terms of the audio in both games, and especially the first game. Now, the gameplay is what I really want to talk about here. The gameplay is what makes these things stand out to me. Now, it's typical Japanese RPG turn-based. You know, you've got your dungeon crawling, you've got, you know, going around opening chests. It's not so much like an action RPG where you're doing a ton of looting of bodies. You usually get cash and some basic restorative items when you're fighting bad guys. You're not getting armor and stuff and that you're going to equip immediately or take back to town and sell. It's not that kind of Diablo action RPG type looting. It's more the traditional Final Fantasy. You mostly get just experience and cash from bad guys, and then you open up chests that are scattered around the place for some other goodies. Most of the upgrading that you do is going to be in town with the cash that you find from fighting monsters. You're going to be learning new spells as you progress through the game. And you've got your typical, like, magic versus physical attacks and bad guys that are going to be strong or weak against those, and including, you know, the whole gamut of elemental attacks, and some bad guys are weak to these elements and strong to others. It's that very typical kind of, you know, Japanese RPG kind of stuff. You've got some status effects and then healing to counteract those, and also some preventative measures to prevent being, you know, poisoned or whatever. But there are some key differences, and they make all the difference. One is your main character. His name is Yuri, which is a pretty common name in Japanese anime and RPGs and stuff. So Yuri, might as well call him Hiro or whatever. But he has these transformations that kind of take the place of summons to a degree in this game. There are other characters that have like these summon animations. Like the spell animations are not just like glowy sparkles and shoot. You know, some of them are very elaborate. Like the spy in the first game, she can like call in. All of her things involve calling in for support. She gets on her walkie-talkie and she's like, yeah, I can use some help here. You know, and then they'll send in like a dive bomber that'll like, you know, shoot rockets at the bad guys, you know, or something else like that. But Yuri, he transforms into these monsters, and over the course of the game, he learns to transform into more and more monsters. And these are unique monsters. They're not monsters that you fight during the game. They're monsters unique to him that he can turn into. And every time he changes, you know, it's like a monster movie. He's like, you know, and then he like totally, you know, there's a big flash and then he's this big hulking beast or whatever. And and each one of these monsters has a whole different set of kind of like spell attacks that they can do. I mean, so it's really cool unlocking all those, seeing and choosing the right monster for the right occasion and stuff. I mean, really cool stuff. Sanity points is a big part of this game. So you've got your hit points, which, you know what that does, magic points, and then you've got these sanity points. And in the first game, which is really dark and very Cthulhu-ish, and it makes the most sense. As soon as battle starts, everybody starts at their max sanity points. But every turn, they lose a sanity point. It goes down and down and down. And Yuri, in addition to that, whenever he turns into one of these monsters, he loses maybe like a big chunk of sanity points, depending on what kind of monster he's turning into. And when they run out of sanity points, they go berserk. They just flip out and they start attacking, you know, their friends, or they started sometimes attacking the bad guys and stuff. And it's a neat little thing that you kind of have to keep track of. And yeah, you've got, like, just like you have healing potions and mana potions, you've got sanity potion type things that you can take to kind of fill that up. But just thematically, it's a cool idea because it represents this idea that the longer that you're interacting with these crazy otherworldly situations, the more it's kind of eating away at your sanity, and eventually you're just gonna snap, you know? And so I just love how mechanically that fits in with the feel of the first game. It's continued on in the second game, but because of the generally lighter tone, it's still largely a dark setting in the second game, but comparatively speaking, to the first game, it's definitely lighter. And so it doesn't feel quite as natural to have the sanity points there. And then I think they continue on in, I don't remember, I didn't play all the way through the third game, but I think the sanity points does continue, and in there it doesn't make any sense because that's such a light game. I'm going to talk about that toward the end here. So sanity points, very cool, very cool. And then the judgment ring. This is probably the most memorable, unique attribute of this game. Whenever you're in combat and you're about to execute an attack or execute a spell, or even, you know, or heal somebody, or drink a potion, or when you're shopping in freaking town, this judgment ring comes up, and it's a disc, and as soon as it appears, these little wedges in the disc appear. Some of them are really thin, some of them are really thick, and then and as soon as they all appear, usually there are one, two, maybe three or more of them, then a little, like, watch hand begins to spin around the disc, and you have to hit, like, the X button as it passes into these wedges, these little zones of activation. And if you get the first one, then, you know, it'll keep spinning, and you can try to hit the second one and the third one, or however many there are. The more of them that you hit as it spins around, and it just goes around once usually, then the more effective your attack is going to be. In some cases, your attack will either be less effective or won't work at all, or whatever it is that you're doing won't work at all if you miss any of those. Or if you get the first one, but then the second one you miss, then the judgment ring just shuts off, and all you got was the first one. You don't even get a chance to hit the remaining hit areas. And the thing spins around at varying speeds, but mostly it's like, so like maybe 1 to 2 seconds to spin around. So, you know, as you're playing the game, you're like going, okay, I'm going to attack, and then you go, X, you know, as the thing is spinning around. And so this very simple element I was very afraid of when I first played this game, because I'd never played any kind of game like this that really required this kind of skill. There was Final Fantasy VIII and Super Mario Bros. RPG, which would give you some bonuses if you hit a button at the right time during an attack, but this game actually was dependent upon being able to do that in order to execute your attacks successfully. If you, like, totally have no hand-eye coordination whatsoever, which I'm pretty close to, then, you know, this would be a very frightening thing, and it was for me, but I was able to, you know, figure it out after just a few tries. And if you're playing this on newer TVs, you're going to have to go into your TV and turn on the game mode if your TV has one. Otherwise, it's going to screw up your timing, and you'll find these difficult or non-intuitive to do. So if you have a game mode and you play this, you'll want to turn that game mode on. But anyway, this made all the difference for me playing this game, to be able to do this. It just added a level of engagement that I wasn't expecting to enjoy, but I found so riveting. And after playing it this way, it was hard for me, it still is hard for me, to go back and even play traditional, completely turn-based JRPGs that I once loved, because they don't have this element involved. Even like the Final Fantasy active time battle system, it's not the same for me. This is just more, it's, you know, because that is just kind of like stresses me out, because you just got to think fast. And if you can usually adjust that active time system and how fast combat moves in those games. But this is different. It's not about, like, constantly moving, like, oh, choose your action. Oh, what's my whole strategy? Oh, no, 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 no. No, it's, you get to choose carefully what your strategy is going to be, but then the moment arrives when it's time to execute, and you got to, like, focus in and go, ba, 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 you know, to do the epic, awesome spell that's, like, 90th level or whatever. No, they don't have levels, but anyway, so that's really cool. I've never seen this kind of combat system done as well before or since. As I said, Final Fantasy VIII and Super Mario RPG were a little bit different, and also I didn't think were near as fun. I often didn't even try to do those extra bonus damage things in those games. And then there was a game called Lost Odyssey. It was the first RPG I played on the Xbox 360, which had something similar. It had like a ring within a ring that would like expand and shrink and stuff, and it just wasn't as good as this. It wasn't as engaging as this. Now, just briefly, I'll talk about From the New World, Shadow Hearts From the New World. That game, the third in the series, features an all-new cast. It was actually produced by a different studio, still the same publishers, I believe, but it was a different studio, and it totally shows. It's got an all-new main cast with little to no connection to previous games outside of near-identical gameplay. So if the gameplay in these first two games is enough to sell you on getting the third one, and like you're just in it for the gameplay, and none of the downsides that I mentioned of the second one bother you at all, then give the third one a try. You might totally dig it. But if the changes I'm describing to Covenant, involving it being lighter and more kind of Japanese anime-like and goofy and silly and stuff, if that kind of stuff would bother you, just avoid Shadow Hearts From the New World, because it is a bright, like neon primary colored game in comparison to the first two games, and it's a lot more quote unquote jokey and silly and all the stuff you would come to expect from goofy silly Japanese anime. That entire dark backdrop to the game is lost in From the New World. It's such a shame, especially with a name like Shadow Hearts. You know, the use of the word shadow just implies a sense of darkness, and that's just virtually absent from the New World. So I just can't recommend that one. I didn't even finish playing it myself. I played through about maybe 80% of it, and I was like, finally, just done. I got life to live, you know? Now, you can play the first game by itself without feeling any compellment. There's a word there. I'll let you fill it in. To play the second. But if you play Covenant, the story does circle around nicely at the end to complement the story of Shadow Hearts 1. So that's why I've kept Shadow Hearts Covenant. I do think it's not as strong of a game as the original Shadow Hearts, but it's strong enough, and then it nicely circles around at the end to complement the story of the first one that I've kept it. I'm actually playing through the second one again right now. I've played through the first one 3 times. This will be, I think, my 3rd time now going through the second one as well. So let's talk about relevance. Is there anything of philosophical or moral significance that might stimulate thought or conversation during playing this game or after playing it or whatever? Well, toward the end of the first game, it's subtly suggested that God, capital G God, is a giant alien from across the universe that wants to destroy all humanity. And that kind of fits in with kind of the Cthulhu thing, where the gods are these ancient beings that awaken from slumber to devour all of humanity. And the final battle in that game, I mean, this is, I guess, minor spoilers. It's not really a plot issue, but you're going to fight this thing, this God thing. It's not referred to with a lowercase g. It's not referred to as being a god. The story plays out as though you are going up against the god that many people around the world believe in as part of their religion, who in the Shadow Hearts universe is just one of many of these aliens that live on the other side of the universe. Also in the first game, your primary healer casts spells using a variety of holy books, one of which is the Bible, the rest being largely fictitious religious / supernatural books. So, but I mean, the idea there is, okay, well, the Bible comparatively is actually a low-level spell book, if you will, that she can use to combat these evils. So there's certainly, you know, relativism and universalism alive and well in that first game. And in Shadow Hearts Covenant, the main bad guy is an elite agent of the Catholic Church. Now, he's part of an organization that is actually not part of the Catholic Church, and he's just kind of like embedded or something in the Catholic Church, but and he wears these vestments that are like a cross between the Pope's getup and like what a kung fu guy would wear in a dojo for a sparring session, you know? So it's kind of a weird thing, but, you know, so big shocker, the Catholic Church once again is portrayed as corrupt in geek entertainment, you know? I mean, at the time it felt mildly daring or controversial, and now honestly it just feels tired to have like the monotheistic organized religion of the world harbor the greatest evil. Ooh, big shocker, you know? Also in Shadow Hearts Covenant is what would today be considered pretty homophobic treatment of gay characters. There are a couple of shopkeepers that you see throughout the game who behave like a strong comedic stereotype of gay men, you know, that kind of very flamboyantly gay type of stereotype. And some of the main characters react to them in what would be considered very homophobic ways, just kind of cringing and like, keep him away from me, you know, that kind of thing. So it's hard to say if a given homosexual would be offended by these portrayals. However, you know, and the reason I say that is because, you know, some homosexuals that I've met, they seem to embrace and even thrive off of that flamboyant homosexual stereotype, whereas others do not. So I think it's just going to differ on the individual. I'm ashamed to say there was a time that, you know, in the right company, I might have laughed at this kind of humor and these kind of jokes, or at least getting a little chuckle or something like that. But honestly, you know, playing through Shadowheart's Covenant now, it, you know, just kind of leaves a bad taste in my mouth. I think that kind of humor, it just doesn't have any usefulness at all, and I think can only do harm. So to sum up, if you want a PS2 Japanese RPG, but would like just a touch of action to keep you on your toes, this is like a bridge between the worlds of Diablo and a True Blue turn-based RPG. It's got just a little bit of action to keep you engaged and on your toes. So, and also, if you like dark supernatural settings, definitely give at least the first game a try. Both of these first two games can be found for around $30 on Amazon. I think the third one can too. Anyway, Shadow Hearts is rated mature for blood, gore, and violence. And Shadowheart's Covenant, is rated teen for language, partial nudity, suggestive themes, and violence. Do yourself a favor, go check them out. Feedback, input, always want to hear from you guys. You can request some kind of a segment or give me your thoughts, whatever. Or if you ever have like a question about something, like I wonder what Pater's take on blank would be. Or if you have a question about something that I said that I can clarify for you, whatever. It all helps me make the show better. So go to spiritblade.net/underground to record a message with your computer. Or you can send me an email, of course, at paeter@spiritblade.net. And as always, I want to remind you guys to go to youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral, where you'll find video versions of much of the content that you get on this show, including this week, the video version of my thoughts on Shadow Hearts and Shadow Hearts Covenant, which in the background running is footage from both of those games. So if you want to get my thoughts and see visually my passion for those games and also see the game itself as it plays, then go to youtube.com/ChristianGeekCentral where you can check out that video. I want to remind you guys, we're always looking for what I call CGC scanners. That's people that are into keeping tabs on cool geeky stuff that they're into and would be interested in keeping the rest of us keeping us in the loop. That's what I said last time. I should just stick to that one. Okay, anyway, or if you got something else that you just want to share and talk about, I want to greatly expand the number of Christian Geek voices at Christian Geek Central. So for more information, email me at paeter@spiritblade.net. As a reminder, guys, I'm off grid until Tuesday, March 3rd. So if you're not hearing back from me via your, you know, with emails and stuff like that, that would be why. It's certainly nothing personal at all. In fact, you should get an auto response that tells you that I'm off grid. I'm just working my butt off, if all is going to plan, on Spirit Blade: A World of Shadows so that I can get that out to you guys on the estimated release of October 2015, which I'm very excited about. Well, as I wrap up here, I want to thank David Arrington for sending in his thoughts on Doctor Who this week. And I want to thank Ken from Honolulu, who I forgot to thank last week. I'm so sorry, Ken. But thank you very much for your alternative thoughts on Odd Thomas. Guys, stay tuned for Farscape Shawarma after the credits if you want, or jump back to episode 310 to start from the beginning. Next week, if God wants it to happen, part two of some thoughts on Doctor Who season two from David Arrington, and my review of the book Beyond the Cosmos, which if you're into the exploration of crazy ideas, you know, about that science fiction often presents, and you want to exercise those muscles as you contemplate and try to figure out, okay, who is this God that we worship? How does he function? You know, and how does he relate to us, these limited creatures that exist in only four space-time dimensions, and he exists in dimensions far beyond those? And or if you're interested in like questions about like how in the world can God be in control of everything and at the same time How can we have choices that are meaningful and real? How can those two possibly coexist? Well, Beyond the Cosmos is a book that tackles those topics and a bunch more fascinating stuff that I think geeks will find very interesting, that they'll be apt to understand and kind of grasp. And we'll get a kick out of, but also find useful and helpful as they consider, you know, their relationship with God and how we approach everyday life in light of who He is. So come back next time to check that out. Till then, thanks so much, guys, for making time for this show. I hope that you have a great week and that you join me next time here on the Spirit Blade Underground podcast as we continue to geek out and seek the truth.
The Spirit Blade Underground is a community-supported endeavor of Spirit Blade Productions. This podcast is produced by Peter Frenson with support from the Christian Geek Central community at christiangeekcentral.com. For information about the latest entertainment and resources from Spirit Blade Productions, visit spiritblade.net. Thank you for listening.
All right, so part two, season two of Farscape, liars, guns, and money. It's hard, you know, I think of these all as kind of like one big episode because it's kind of like watching a movie, which reminds me, something I wanted to comment on from the previous episode was Scorpius' cooling unit inside of his skull. That was freaking awesome. That still looks great. I mean, I can't think of a show today that would have that kind of effect, or at least, if not that kind of effect, not that kind of, like, gross quality to it, you know? I'm thinking that at the time that this came out, which is late 90s, 1999 or 2000, I think is when it started airing, you really wouldn't see this kind of gory, kind of body horror type stuff on network television. And so I think that it being a cable show, a show on the Sci-Fi Channel, really helped it have the freedom to have those kinds of things where, like, this swirling cylinder could come out of a dude's skull and have little bloody bits of brain matter hanging on it. So that was very cool. So Stark, I don't really like Stark. He's kind of like what Deanna Troi was to me on Star Trek The Next Generation, but, like, amped up 100-fold. You know, Deanna Troi was like, she was just there to be emotional and to be, and to feel emotional things. Like, when they would come across some, you know, anomaly of the week, and she'd be like, "Oh, Captain, I feel something," and then she would faint, you know, or something. And then we'd know that there's something going on, you know, that, oh, we better be concerned. Because Deanna Troi's feeling things, and it's concerning her and making her feel faint. And, like, Stark is just, he just is, like, that kind of person that, like, just seems to invite drama into their lives. And so it just is tremendously draining to be around them because they are overreacting and panicking and getting stressed out about everything. And their life, they're just a big victim, and they're just, their life is full of stress and, you know. Oh my gosh. So, you know, when he freaks out about all the slaves, I think, getting killed or something, I can't remember why he freaked out. I can imagine the conversation where, you know, the director is maybe, or maybe the actor, you know, is like, "Okay, so since I normally kind of freak out about everything, I gotta, like, really freak out, super duper freak out," when something like this happens, you know? So, oh, jeez. So I was just like, "Oh, Stark, shut up, stop screaming," you know. And that's the thing with this show. There's always at least one character in the ensemble cast that I just don't like. That when they come on screen, I'm just like, ugh, you know. I know that Matt McKinney in The Community hates, what's-her-face, Chiana. And Chiana, I don't mind. You know, I mean, she's brings a lot of frustrating things to other characters, you know, but she doesn't annoy me. Like, say, Zan, she can, you know, in moderation, I'm fine with Zan, and in moderation, I'm fine with Stark, but it's when they're really, you know, playing their characters up to 10. I'm like, and there'll be more of those characters in the future that will join the ensemble cast that I will, I'll hate just as much. But anyway, man, I'm spending a lot of time talking about those few details, but there's so much going on in this episode. I'm going to forget a million different things that I like about this episode. I love the payoff and the resolution with, Rigel and, Durka. Oh my gosh. When he, like, you know, he zaps him, and then you're thinking, at least I was thinking, okay, so he's out cold. But then, like, the next time you see Rigel, he's got Durka's head on a stick. Oh my gosh. That was so crazy. And very intense. And it, you know, it again establishes Rigel as more capable than we think he is, you know? Like, he'll have these moments. A lot of the times he's just this selfish little comic relief kind of character. But then every once in a while, and, you know, two of the ones that come to mind right now are associated with Durka, where he is a strong character and a very capable character, you know, when he brings his mind to bear on a situation, you know? Very enjoyable stuff. Gosh, I'm really tired right now. It's really late. And I forgot to record this right after watching the episode. I went and watched Birdman, and then I just recorded my thoughts on that. So I'm, like, super drained right now, and I can't remember many of my thoughts on part two of this episode. Oh, here's something. Scorpius, he is a psychologically complex character. And I think at least half of that is Wayne Pygram's performance as Scorpius. I was thinking while I was watching this time, I've watched a bunch of interviews with Wayne Pygram, seeing him out of the makeup, but I can't imagine, the makeup is so much of who that character is, and what Wayne Pygram brings to it is, gosh, this whole other component. I would love to see him, like, in a rehearsal doing Scorpius without the makeup. Because even though I can see some facial structural similarities between him and Scorpius, to me, like, when I think of Scorpius, it's he is a living, breathing dude. It's like I forget about the makeup. And I just imagine that they cast this really horrific-looking guy to play Scorpius. And he's not wearing makeup. He's just wearing the rubber, the leather mask or whatever, you know. But his skin is his skin. You know, I mean, it's crazy. But, you know, his relationship with Natira, the kind of like the crab spider head chick or whatever she's got going on. She's just open with the fact that she was trying to kill him, you know, and I wouldn't have respected her. And he's totally not threatened by that or angry about that. And they've got this weird sexual relationship going on that at times you're like cocking your head and you're like, is this sex? What are they doing? What are they doing? This is kind of disturbing and totally whacked out, you know. And there's this moment where, like, he's totally got her dead to rights, and you think he's going to react in anger, and instead he reacts in this kind of like it's a sexual overture of some kind, but it's also angry and brutal at the same time. And so it's just like, you know, what is going on with Scorpius? It goes beyond the kind of like the S&M kind of thing. I think there's, like, psychologically there's just something weird going on. Even when they had their kind of first, like, pseudo-sexual encounter, whatever it was they were doing, they didn't even have their clothes off. They were just, like, gripping each other and, like, growling and doing weird pseudo-intimate things, you know. And then when they were done, you know, there's this kind of release, which kind of makes it seem like it was this kind of pseudo-sexual kind of thing. And then she asks him if that was uncomfortable, if it was painful or whatever, and he said it was more complicated than pain, you know? And I just love that line because, it just makes you wonder, what is going on in this guy's head? What was he getting out of that experience when there was some, you know, something related to pain involved? It was just like, he's just a sick puppy, you know? both of them, they're just sick, sick people, you know? So, you know, just some great ways in which they're playing them up as, like, villains who do and enjoy things that just make you go, ew. So, you know, only on Farscape. Only on Farscape. That's all I can think of right now. I'm tired. I gotta go to bed. So, but I, you know, I'm definitely on a roll with these kind of these trilogy episodes. For a while there, I was kind of putting off, and it was slow to get around to watching episodes of Farscape, you know. And so, I was like, just managing to watch an episode in time to have the Farscape Schwarmer ready for the show. But, you know, ever since like one or two episodes before this trilogy, I have been like ahead of the game. I'm just like, boom, boom, boom. I'm watching, you know, two or maybe even three a week now. So, yeah, these things are really ramping up.